to class number 4 of 6. Just a note, next Saturday, if you come here, you'll be alone. We have our Jesus conference at the Four Point Sheraton. And I will be teaching a class next Saturday. But if you've been coming to this class, don't come to that class, because it'll be a repeat, a quick version of the first 2 weeks, basically, and actually part of today's class. All right? Yes, let's turn those phones off. It's being recorded. Sorry. It's being recorded. It's all right.
And you're recording this?
Yes, I'm recording.
Oh, you're going to sell it then?
No, it's going to be free. And they're finding, right now they're hearing you asking about the price.
Yeah, that's good. And now you're telling me it's free, so now you can't charge me.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. People aren't going to come to the class anymore if the recordings are free. All right. So we're discussing messianic prophecies, which I believe is some of the most convincing evidence. In fact, if you can look at the sum total of messianic prophecies and think that Jesus is not who's being prophesied, I don't know. It's like, what planet are you living on? And like I said, those who want to undermine this evidence, they do so, what they have to do is they have to do it one verse at a time. So they'll take one passage and find a way to ignore that one. And then they'll take another passage and try to find a way to ignore that one. And each one at a time, they'll say this thing in Isaiah 9 is everybody, all the scholars know it's really about King Josiah. Remember I said the one in Psalm 22, which is the funniest of all. They say it's not talking about piercing, it's talking about camels. All right? And so, anybody who's willing to even have the courage to look at the evidence on the face of it, the whole evidence, who doesn't conclude that Jesus is the Messiah, I don't know what to say about those people. All right, so anyway, we already saw Luke 24:44, where Jesus said he understood that all the prophecies about the Messiah were fulfilled in him. All right, he saw that. The law of Moses, the prophet, and the Psalms, which is the three divisions of the Hebrew Bible. So then we asked, well, how do we know these things actually happened before Jesus lived? And, were written before Jesus lived. By the way, I'm not feeling too well. I've had a kind of a bad headache and I'm kind of spacey. So if I say thing in the wrong order, just give me a little bit of grace. I'm just hanging in there today. So anyway, I can't prove to you that Psalms are written around 130 or 140 B.C., Psalm 22. What I can do is I can prove to you beyond any reasonable doubt that it was certainly written at least by 300 B.C., almost certainly before that, 300 years beforehand. Is that enough to kind of say, yeah, all right, that's looking pretty good?
Yeah.
It'd be like I said, yeah, you know, I prophesy that in the year 2315, Ecuador is going to be the most powerful nation in the world. And a guy named Bill from Ecuador is going to be the president. And if that happened, then you'd say that guy's a prophet. It's kind of that kind of stuff we're talking about here. All right, so we have the Isaiah scroll and the Septuagint translations that show that. How do I know these things really happen? Like I said, for the 8 or 10 passages I'm using as my main presentation, over half of these things that are prophesied, their fulfillment is a matter of historical record outside the Bible. And by what standard do you deny everything ever written by anybody in the Bible as all being a bunch of lies? But we'll just concede that point, mostly. Okay? And then the next question is, how do we know that these are actually prophecies of the Messiah? And my response to that is, it's well known the Jews expected a Messiah. When Jesus said he was the Messiah, people knew exactly who he was talking about. And all but one of the passages I'm using in this main outline were considered messianic by the Jews before Jesus was born. So that kind of nails it. Okay? The only exception is Psalm 22. But Psalm 22, if you don't think that's about the Messiah, then who do you think it's about? Okay? So question number 4. Could Jesus, planning on deceiving the people into believing he was the Messiah, have kind of manipulated situations so that he could fulfill these prophecies? The answer is, for about a third of them he could have. All right, but even those would have gotten him killed, and the rest of them, no, I don't think so. Unless, of course, he's God in the flesh. All right, so we looked at Isaiah 53, being rejected, being silent, being pierced. We looked at Micah 5:2, which said he needs to be born in Bethlehem. And then Isaiah 9, 1 and 6, which said he had to actually come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. And we saw the maps there. Zebulun and Naphtali, the border between the two, is right where Nazareth is. Then we looked at Psalm 22, which specifically said that the Messiah should be pierced by hands and feet. And it doesn't say none of his bones would be broken. It simply says, I can count all my bones. But if you combine that with the command regarding the Passover to not break any of their bones, and other passages that specifically talk about none of his bones being broken, but we know that it's about a person being crucified and yet none of his bones being broken. Okay? That being crucified was not that unusual in, you know, 30 AD, and even being crucified and not having your bones broken was not unusual because the crucifixion was designed to not break the bones. Okay, however, given the circumstances we know about Jesus, the one on his right and the one on his left had their bones broken, and given that crucifixion wasn't even invented for 300 years after David wrote this psalm, and crucifixion by piercing of hands and feet wasn't invented until about 900 years after David wrote the psalm, that's a pretty strong case, I would say. And then it says, they divided my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Now, the question is, which did they do? Did they divide his garments or cast lots for his garments? The answer is, they did both. Okay, great. So apparently we covered that one. Awesome. All right. Yes?
A lot of the psalms, it sounds like David was on the run. So when he's writing these verses, what do you think might have been going through his mind? I don't think he was thinking.
I have no idea what was going through his mind. See, some of the psalms that are messianic kind of makes sense, for example, Psalm 2, verse 1. I believe it's a messianic psalm, but to some extent it makes sense about David as well. Psalm 2, verse 1. Why do the nations conspire, the peoples plot in vain, the kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord, against his anointed one? Okay? I think David could have written that and thought of it as being about himself. Yeah. But it's a messianic passage, no question about it, because the word anointed is Messiah, against the Messiah. So that one, I'd say, is clearly a messianic passage, and that in that case, David recognized it as being about himself. But in Psalm 22, I have no idea what David thought when he wrote that. I very, very much doubt it had anything to do with his actual life. He must have just written that across the page and said, why did I just say that? But that's true of a number of things. Like, and we did our class on Daniel, when he talks about the ten-horned beast and the little beast and all that sort of stuff. All these things are fulfilled in fantastic detail. It's not about Jesus. That's not why we're covering it in this class. So, yeah.
I was thinking that, you know, even in the New Testament, it talks about the prophets seeing only dimly.
Right.
Seeing. So the prophets spoke only what they were told to speak,
right,
but they not necessarily knew what it was they were talking about. They just knew that God told them to do it, so they did it, and then just...
Right, but we should understand, as we're going to see later on in the class today, that David was a prefigure of the Messiah. And being a prefigure of the Messiah, some things that happened to him parallel what happened to Jesus, simply because he's a prefigure of the Messiah. So that makes it a little bit complicated. One thing I say is Psalms 22 is awesome evidence for Jesus. That's pretty good stuff. Okay. Now let's go to Zechariah 11. Now, the case that Zechariah 11 is a messianic prophecy is it requires a little bit of Jewish understanding to get this one. All right. In fact, what I'll do is I'll go back to verse 10, Zechariah 11. Then I took my staff called favor, and I broke it, revoking the covenant I made with all the nations. So he's talking about an event that's going to end the covenant, the old covenant here. It was revoked on that day. If so, the afflicted of the flock were watching me knew it was the word of the Lord. I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they priced me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver, threw them into the house of the Lord, to the potter. Then I broke my second staff called union, breaking the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. He's talking about the events separating the northern and southern kingdom and also the ending of the old covenant. All right, so anybody know how many pieces of silver Jesus was betrayed for?
30.
Now, I will admit, remember I said one of the four problems is, how do we know that this actually happened? I'll admit that this particular detail is not recorded except in the scriptures. Okay, I'll admit that. All right, but again, like we said earlier, if you're telling a lie, what you do is you give as few details as possible in the hopes that those who are aware of what's really going on won't be able to uncover it. Why did they say it was 30 pieces of silver? I assume it's because it was 30 pieces of silver. Because, you know, we have to understand that this was written, let me see, it's in Matthew. Matthew's written in the early 60s A.D., 30 years after the events. Do you think the people who were in that room who paid 30 pieces of silver were still alive? Most of them, not all of them. All right, we don't hear the Jewish sources. You don't read the part in the Talmud which says these Christians lied and said he was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver because we were there. All right, 30 pieces of silver. Now, I like to imagine, you know, a few weeks, a few months later, these guys who'd paid 30 pieces of silver for the death price for Jesus, I like to imagine them reading Zechariah 11 and kind of going, oh, man, I said 30. Should have paid him 60 or given him, I don't know, some sheep or something like that. 30 pieces of silver. All right? That's pretty awesome. And then what did they do with the money? Well, you can read Matthew 27, 3 through 8. What happened was Judas came back in. He was remorseful. I think his plan was to incite Jesus to rebel militarily, not necessarily to get Jesus killed. I don't know that for a fact, but that's my opinion. It didn't work, so either way, Judas comes back in. He throws the 30 pieces of silver into the temple in front of these guys who'd given it to him, and they refused to take the money. And what they did was they went out and bought a potter's field. It's pretty specific. Remember my example about the president of Ecuador in the year 23-something is going to be the king of the world? You know, crazy stuff. 30 pieces of silver used to buy a potter's field. All right? So, I don't know. That points to me that Jesus is the Messiah, that he is who he said he was. Okay, then there's Daniel 9. That's one of my favorites. Daniel 9. Like I said, you know what? It's the over 30-year-olds. It's the over 30-year-olds. The young set. See, in my classes, phones don't go off anymore. They don't. It never happens anymore. It's only the over 30s, which, by the way, I'm one of them, just so you know. It's all right. We forgive you. Yes? Oh, what it is a place they took the pot shirts. So the people who made pots, the ones that broke, it was basically the trash place where they threw the pieces of pottery that weren't useful. Like a dump, yeah. Yeah. And they used it to buy it for, I think, as a burial field afterwards. I think they used it for that purpose. All right? Very good. So Daniel 9, starting in verse 24. Now, the context here is Daniel had been reading Jeremiah, probably Jeremiah 29 or 25, in which it had said 70 years of captivity, after which the people would be set free. The year was roughly 538 B.C. Daniel had been in captivity since 605, so it had been around 67, 68 years he'd been in captivity. So he read the prophecy in Jeremiah. You can read about that in Daniel 9, verse 1 and 2. And so he started praying, God, hey, time's up. Let's get going. And so he prays for God to set his people free. But God fulfills the prophecy in a way that Daniel had no idea quite unexpectedly. All right? So you can see while I was praying, speaking and praying, the prayer was answered. All right, verse 24. 70 sevens are decreed for your people and for your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know and understand this, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It will be built in, with streets in a trench, but in times of trouble. Okay, good. So this is as clear a messianic prophecy as it could possibly be. It's talking about somebody coming to Jerusalem to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy one. It's talking about the Messiah, clearly. So this is a prophecy about the Messiah coming to Jerusalem. No question about it. Clearly messianic, and the Jews acknowledged that at that time. Then he says when it's going to happen. He says 77s. Hopefully you don't need your calculator for this one.
Yeah.
All right. 490, what? Well, you know, the way it works with biblical prophecy is trying to interpret it before it's fulfilled is kind of not a good game. It's really a prideful, arrogant game in general. But after it's been fulfilled, then you have the right to go back and say, all right, apparently this is what it meant. And apparently it means 490 years, as we'll see in a minute. All right, it says, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, when was this decree issued? Well, it turns out Cyrus the Great issued a decree in 538 B.C. In fact, if you go to the British Museum, it's a version of it is there. It's the Cyrus cylinder. And what he said was that the people can go back to their cities and rebuild their temples. Okay? But what he didn't allow them to do is build their cities. And then there was another decree in 519 where Darius said to the Jews, how come you haven't built your temple? And those are in Ezra chapter 1 and Ezra chapter, I think it's chapter 3, I'm not sure. But in neither case were the Jews authorized to build the walls of the city. The decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem is found in Ezra chapter 7, verse 12 through 26. It was issued in 458 B.C., it's the seventh year of Artaxerxes. You can check it out and do all the historical research. Okay, great. So 458 B.C. Let's subtract 490. All right? And the answer is negative 32. So what year would that be? 32 A.D. No, not exactly, because there was no year zero. No year zero. So the calendar went from 1 B.C. to 1 A.D. So basically then, what it's saying is the Messiah is going to come to Jerusalem to bring in everlasting righteousness, to bring in forgiveness of sins, and to be anointed as most holy, about 33 A.D. All right? Now remember, we're going to go through this list of qualifications for a Messiah. But one of them is requires being in Jerusalem around 33 A.D. All right? By the way, if you read the prophecy a little bit more carefully, says seven sevens and 62 sevens. You see that part? The prophecy actually says it'd be during the final week. And that final week would be 27 AD to 33 AD. Smack in the middle of that is 30 AD, which is probably the year Jesus was actually killed. All right, so what we have here is a prophecy of when the Messiah would be killed and be anointed as the most holy. Alright? Now, did Jesus fulfill that one?
Yes.
Alright, is that a matter of historical record?
Yes.
Yes. Could have arranged that. Well, kind of. I mean, Jesus was well aware that there was a time, a right time, the perfect time for him to die. In fact, later on in the class today, we're going to see a little bit more details about that timing and having to happen on the eve of the Passover. Alright, so anybody who wants to claim to be the Messiah has to be born in Bethlehem. Any candidates here? Got to get born in Bethlehem. You have to be raised in Galilee, in the region very within a few miles of where Nazareth is today. You have to get despised and rejected. Pedro says, yeah, I'm a teacher. That happens to me all the time. You have to be meek and silent before your accusers. You have to get pierced. Not only do you have to get pierced, you also have to get crucified. Both. All right, you have to have your garments divided over and gambled over, both, which is what they did. They got to the inner garment, they divided, they gambled over it. You have to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. And you have to come to Jerusalem to make atonement for sin somewhere around 30 A.D. and about 25 other prophecies. Now, anybody who thinks that Jesus is not the Messiah, the one prophesied in the Old Testament, they, I don't know, they have to kind of explain this to me. So what's your basis for rejecting this conclusion? Now, again, what, like I said, what they'll do is they'll try to find a reason to ignore each one of these passages individually, all right, and in, with varying degrees of success, I guess, all right? I don't know. Pretty convincing picture. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else to say. Pretty. And by the way, I would suggest you have this study with somebody sometime. This is a great study. You got somebody who's, you know, generally, you know, sort of intellectual slash belief issues are not the main issue, but sometimes it's a sticking point. And, you know, because what happens is we come up against something that we don't really want to do, and in our mind we turn it into an issue about some evidence thing. And that's fine. If this helps somebody over the bump, then amen for that. So, I don't know. I think it's pretty awesome. By the way, there are other messianic prophecies we could mention. Just throw them out there. All right. For example, oops, got to switch pages on my notes here. Move forward a few pages. All right, great. And by the way, in the notes, which are at my website and also at the church website now, there's like, I don't know, 20 or 30 prophecies. You could look at some of those if you want to. And that's not all of them, not even close. Okay, let's go to Isaiah 7:14. Now, what I've done is I've included some other prophecies of the Messiah that I think are pretty amazing. They definitely increase my faith. I don't put, when I do my standard, I guess, presentation, if you will, on messianic prophecies, I don't include these, not because I don't believe that they are messianic and that they're awesome, amazing evidence that Jesus fulfilled them, but I'll explain in each case why I don't actually include them in that presentation. Okay, so there's Isaiah 7:14. All right. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. All right, so take the battery out. No, he probably has an emergency, and I'm being not loving. I'm sorry. Joe's awesome.
Yep.
Yes. One of our best students. You got one of those certificates from the last class.
That's right.
All right. So this is a prophecy, and we see this as being messianic, because it does say his name will be God. Emmanuel is God living among us. God living among us. Who else is going to be called God living among us? All right? So... and by the way, here's the rub, if you will, not to me as a Christian. I mean, this is obvious that God is saying there's going to be a virgin, she's going to have a child, and he's going to be God in the flesh. I mean, it's pretty obvious to me. But it just so happens that the Hebrew word here that's used is the word Alma. And the word Alma means a young woman, not necessarily a virgin, it's just a young woman. All right, so if you had a woman, say, 17 years old who was married, she would be called an Alma. All right, so that's true. However, it's worth noting that it said it will be a sign and a miracle. So let's say a woman is married and has sex and then has gets pregnant. Would that be a sign? Obviously not. And it's not surprising that the Septuagint translation, which was made 250 years before Christ, the Greek word that was used in place of Alma was the word parthenos, which means virgin. Well, why would the translators, Jewish translators, by the way, But Jewish translators would not use that word anymore for obvious reasons. For the same reason they dropped most of the messianic prophecies from their services. A little cynicism there, if you will. But anyway, they used the word Parthenos, which literally means a virgin. Well, why they have done that? Because why else would it be a miracle and a sign unless it had been a virgin? Now, the critics say, well, this is actually about King Jehoahaz or something like that. Okay, fine. Did King Jehoahaz have a child? Well, no, not that we know of, but he probably did. And would they have called him God among us? Well, sure. I mean, he's the king. So, you know, that's the thing. So anyway, that's why I don't use that one in my presentation, because people who read up on this stuff would kind of come back with the same, well, the word doesn't mean virgin. Okay? Now, all Bible translations say virgin. Why? Well, duh. You know, I mean, if you're translating it, the best translation is virgin. They're not doing it because they're Christians trying to convert Jews. All right. Zechariah 9:9-11. Zechariah 9:9-11. Cool stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Now, kings did not ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. They rode in on a horse. But was there ever a king who rode into Jerusalem on a donkey? Yes. Now, you have to understand that when Zechariah wrote this, there were no more kings. The last king had been killed. This is at the time there were no more kings even to ride in. This is a messianic prophecy saying he would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey and a colt, the foal of a donkey. Now, did Jesus ride into Jerusalem on a donkey on a colt, the foal of a donkey?
Yes.
Obviously. You know, again, why would somebody put that in the Gospels if it wasn't true? All right? Now, I suppose it's true that Jesus could arrange it. In fact, wait, did Jesus arrange for this to happen? Yeah, he did. All right? But he fulfilled this prophecy, but that's why I don't include this one in my outline. You can see why, okay? Then there's Genesis 49:10-11. Genesis 49:10-11. He actually did arrange it. He was just trying to get himself killed. Jesus was aware of the timing. Some of the prophecies, such as being killed at the time of the Passover, he was in control of that. Right? He purposely went to Jerusalem. Of course, as a Jew, he needed to go to Jerusalem at that time, but still. Genesis 49:10-11 says here, the scepter will not depart from Judah, or the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. And the obedience of the nations is his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in blood and grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. I don't know what that's about. I suppose Jesus had white teeth. I'm not sure. All right, good. By the way, from what tribe did Jesus come? From the tribe of Judah. All right. And we got the donkey, we got the vine, we got the wine, we got the blood, we got the grapes. All this a reference to Jesus. All right, so I don't know, that's pretty good. Then there's Hosea 11:1. I'll just say it out loud. Out of Egypt I called my son. Now, was Jesus called out of Egypt?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, but that prophecy is fulfilled in multiple ways. It's fulfilled when Moses was called out of Egypt, because Moses is a prefigured Messiah. It was fulfilled when Israel was called out of Egypt, because Israel is, you know, sort of being saved out of Egypt. And we were all called out of Egypt when we were saved. So that's another good one. All right, and then the last one, Isaiah 11:1-2. The last one. The last one we're going to look at, there's lots more. Isaiah 11:1-2. So, I don't know. To me, it's not only is it reasonable to believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that he's God in the flesh, that he is the person about whom the entire Old Testament is written about, Not only is that reasonable, I'd say that to not believe that, it borders on being unreasonable, borders on irrational. All right. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and power, the Spirit of knowledge, and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. All right, this is a messianic prophecy. I know this because the Jews considered a messianic prophecy. In fact, the Messiah was known as the branch of Jesse. Now, there's an interesting passage. It's in Matthew chapter 2, verse 23, where Matthew sees this as a messianic prophecy. Matthew 2, verse 23. Right after the part about being called out of Egypt, by the way, because Matthew is filled with these prophecies and their fulfillments. All right. Could I have somebody read verse 23 for me?
And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth, so it was fulfilled what was said through the prophets that he would be called a Nazarene.
All right, now was Jesus from Nazareth?
Yes.
Yes. In fact, what was the early church called? They were called the Nazarenes. So this is a matter of historical record. But where's the prophecy that says the Messiah would come from Nazareth? The answer is Isaiah 11.
Branch.
Because the word branch is Nazar. So Jesus was a Nazarene. Jesus was the branch of Jesse, and he was a Nazarene, both because he was the son of Jesse and because he was born in a city named Nazareth. Now imagine trying to work that one out. But then God could work all that stuff out. That's pretty cool, I would say. Okay, great. So, I'm going to move on to the next topic. Any points, questions, comments about messianic prophecy? Yeah, go ahead.
There's some statistic out there about the probability of somebody being able to fulfill all the prophecies in 1 in a trillion or something.
No, it's zero. It's zero. There's no probability. You can't calculate. I mean, in mathematics, I don't really like doing that whole probability thing. I think it doesn't really, the numbers don't really mean anything. But in mathematics, there's a number below which it's sort of semi-officially zero. I don't know, it's 10 to the minus 56 or something like that. And the probability is zero. There's no probability. You can't calculate it. Because, the whole dying in Jerusalem by crucifixion on the eve of the Passover, all right, you know, in the year 30 AD, you can't calculate that probability. It's fun to some people, but a waste of time, in my opinion, for what it's worth. Yeah?
I heard the number was the number 1 over the number of silver dollars it would take to cover the state of Texas.
Oh, well, that's not very big.
Number. Yeah,
that's not even a big number compared to the, yeah, all right.
A large number.
Texas is big. Yes? Well, that was prophesied right there in Daniel chapter 9. I didn't finish. Again, I'm purposely focusing in on prophecies specific about the Messiah. We could do a thing on prophecy in general, and we could go on quite a bit longer. All right. But yes, it was prophesied both by Daniel and by Jesus that the temple would be destroyed and that the abomination of desolation would be performed on the temple. And we know that's what happened because Josephus tells us that. He tells us that after the temple was destroyed, Titus went to the Temple Mount and he offered pagan sacrifice right there on the side of the temple, fulfilled quite specifically as prophesied by Daniel and by Jesus. Yes. All right, so next I'm going to talk a little bit about messianic prefigures and foreshadows. Now, if you were in the mission region a few weeks ago, some of this would be pretty familiar. But then again, I'm going to skip most of that and do other stuff. On the other hand, if you came to our class, was it 2 semesters ago? Everything I say for the next 30, 40 minutes will be familiar, all right? I don't know how many of you came to that class about from Shadow to Reddit. So I apologize for the 20% of you for whom this will be, well, you know, it'll be fun sort of saying it under your, mouthing the words when I'm saying it. But I'm sorry, but this is amazing evidence for Jesus.
Let's go.
To me, oh my goodness. If you can look at all the types, prefigures, and foreshadows that specifically point to Jesus and say that this is a bunch of stuff that was made up in myth and legend and stuff, I don't know where you're coming from. It just doesn't make any sense. That's craziness. It's craziness. Like we read earlier in John 5, what is it, verse 29, where Jesus said that everything must be fulfilled that is written. No, sorry. Let's read it in John 5. Sorry. I was quoting Luke 24 instead of John 5. All right. I'm hanging in there, but just barely. All right. John 5. Is it verse 29? All right. It's in my notes. Right now, my eyes are doing funny things. I can't see. I literally can't see. I can kind of sort of see a little bit. All right. Where is it in John 5? Help me out here.
The verse is... What verse is it?
Oh, that you've been studying the scripture your whole life.
539.
Thank you. 539. I can read it enough to kind of sort of read it. You diligently study the scriptures because you think that by them you possess eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me, yet refuse to come to me to have life. So Jesus is telling the Jews, the teachers of the law, and the Pharisees and the scribes, you guys have been studying the Old Testament your whole life, and what you don't realize is the whole thing was written about me. I mean, imagine this guy. He's saying, your entire religion is about me. That's a pretty outrageous statement. All right? Pretty outrageous statement. We're going to see lots of examples of this. I'm purposely going to choose mostly ones not from the sermon a couple weeks ago. All right? There it is. John 5, 39 and 40. Should have known. All right. All right. Now, what we're going to do, let me see. I took out the outline. Rats. I had an outline that's not in there anymore. That's all right. Numbers 21, 4 through 9.
Let's go.
So what we're going to do is we're going to look at one incident that illustrates this idea that the entire Old Testament is about Jesus. The way I like to do as an illustration, I say that the Old Testament is like a play, but in this play it's very strange because the actors have no idea what this play is about. But the audience does. We're the audience. We know what it's about because, you know, we know the entire plot line. And as we read the Old Testament, we can kind of see those things there. And yet the people who took part in these events had no idea. They traveled from Mount Hor around the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom, but the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake, put it up on a pole, and anyone who's bitten and can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake, put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, he lived. Now, Jesus is going to interpret this as applied to him in John 3:14. So here's the situation. Snake bite. How many snake bites required for death?
One.
And basically then, in this little scenario, the snake bite, the snakes represent sin. And the wages of sin, Romans 6:23, are in fact death. All right, see, you can see some people, you know, you guys have heard this before. It's all right. It's kind of fun, actually. It's pretty amazing. So anyway, so the people are dying, and Moses goes to God and says, "God, what should I do about this?" And God says, "What you need to do is you need to make an image of bronze in the shape of a snake, put it up on a wooden pole, and when people look at the snake, they'll live." And again, Moses had to thought, "All right, God, great, you just told us never ever to make an image of anything, certainly not of an animal, and certainly not a snake. But you say to put it up on a wooden pole, fine, I'll put it up on a wooden pole." And the people looked at it and they lived. But again, Moses is an actor in a play, and he doesn't know what the play is about. It's about Jesus. In fact, the entire gospel story is contained in this story in Numbers chapter 21. The problem is sin. What's the solution?
Jesus.
True, to repent, which they needed to do, obviously. But in the illustration here, the solution was to look to Jesus, who just like the snake, was lifted up on a wooden pole, that when people looked at him, they could live. John 3:14, Jesus said that. John 3:14, since I can't read my notes, it's lucky I've got this memorized. John 3:14. Just as the Son of Man lifted up the snake, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. So he's saying it's exactly the same thing as with Moses. He's interpreting his own life as the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Just like they lifted up Moses, so I too will be lifted up on a wooden pole. But the part that's confusing for me is why you would use a snake as a symbol to represent the Messiah. But then there's Romans 6:23 where it said, there's 2 Corinthians 5:21 where it says, God made him who knew no sin to become sin for us on the cross. Ah, okay, now the story makes sense. So Jesus became sin for us when he was lifted up on a pole, and that's the solution for sin for us. I'm gonna also, and by the way, you could argue for this to be an accident or luck. You know, this just happened to be, you know, a snake, and it just happened to be lifted up on a pole, and it just so happens when they looked at it, they were saved. You could argue for that, or you could say this is a message. This is a prophecy of Messiah. Now, we're going to take a break now, and we're going to do lots more of this kind of stuff. Please see Jan to register. We might have some new registrants. If you're coming here for the first time, you know, if you want to just pay a partial thing, that's fine. If you want to pay the whole thing, that's fine as well. We'll let you make your own choice on that. But either way, get some muffins, coffee. Let's get started, please. This morning, remember, next Saturday, we're not going to be here. I got it. Thanks. We're going to be meeting. We're going to have our Jesus conference at the Four Points Sheraton. I'll be teaching a class on this general topic, but it'll be stuff that I've covered in this class already. And then a week from Saturday, we'll be back here. It'll be on the miracles of Jesus. We're going to do a week on the miracles. We'll have a guest lecturer, Dan Condor, all the way down from L.A., good friend of mine. And then we'll finish up the week after. It'll be April 4th by talking about the resurrection and a few other sort of finishing points there. So that'll be pretty good. All right, so we're going to continue with the topic, the idea of historical prefigures and historical foreshadows. I'm skipping tons and tons of material. Get a copy of my book, From Shadow to Reality. It's over there. I'm going to be doing a lesson from that book tomorrow. I'm preaching tomorrow. And that'll be from another section that I've never really taught on for the church very much. So let's talk about Abraham now. Many prefigures, many foreshadows there in the life of Abraham. Abraham had two children, Ishmael and Isaac. Now, if you were to ask the Jews, which of you is... which represents you, Ishmael, Isaac, they figure that one out right away. They say, we're Isaac. But symbolically, prophetically, that's not true, actually. Prophetically, Ishmael represents the Jews, and Isaac represents us. We are Isaac. We are the spiritual children of Abraham, which is made clear in Romans chapter 4. It says that, Abraham is father of all who were saved, not by works, but by faith. And think about it. Was Ishmael the child of promise?
No.
No? In fact, why was Ishmael born? Because of a lack of faith. In fact, how much faith does it take to make a Jew? Not much faith. You know, you got a mother Jew, you got a father Jew, they hook them up together. Next thing you know, you get a baby Jew, it doesn't take any faith at all. It took no faith at all to become a Jew and even to be a Jew. No, we are the children of promise. We are Isaac. Spiritually and symbolically, we are in fact Isaac. And this is all found in Galatians 4, 21 through 31. Galatians 4, 21 through 31. I can tell Curtis has heard this probably twice, actually. No, that's right. It's really bad when it's Kate. Cause she's, it's really bad. She starts quoting me the right one sentence before to her neighbor. It can get kind of obnoxious. But. All right. Tell me, you who want to be under the law, you're not aware of what the law says, for it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and one by the free woman. His son by the slave woman was born in the ordinary way, like I said. But his son by the free woman was born as a result of a promise. These things can be taken figuratively. And you have to decide for yourself whether they were in fact historical foreshadows, miraculously placed in the Old Testament. You have to decide for yourself. All right? To me, it sure makes sense. All right? For the women represent two covenants. So not only does Ishmael and Isaac represent Israel and the church, but also the parents do as well. All right? So the women represent the two covenants. One covenant is from Mount Sinai and bears children who are to be slaves. And he's talking about the Jews. And Jesus said to the Jews, you're all a bunch of slaves. He says, you're the children of slaves, and you're slaves. Politically, it was true at the time. It was also true spiritually, because everyone who sins is a slave to sin. So they're slaves. He says, so one covenant is from Mount Sinai and bears children to be slaves. This is Hagar. Now, Hagar stands for Mount Sinai in Arabia, corresponds to the present city of Jerusalem. So what he's saying is, Ishmael and Hagar are symbolic of Judaism. Because she is in slavery with her children, but the Jerusalem that is above is free, and she is our mother. He's speaking about the church here, verse 28. Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. And at that time, the son born in the ordinary way persecuted the son born of the, by the power of the Spirit. So he's saying another symbol here is when Isaac was born, Ishmael persecuted him, and he's saying that's exactly what's happening today. Isaac, the church has been born. Ishmael, the Jews are persecuting them in a rather detailed and obvious fulfillment of the prophecy. And it says, goes on, but what does the scripture say? Get rid of the slave woman and her son, for the slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with the free woman's son. And of course, that prophecy was enacted in 70 AD when Jerusalem was destroyed, and God kicked the Jews out of Jerusalem as prophesied when Sarah gave the boot to Ishmael and Hagar. Then there's Genesis 22. Genesis 22, which I think is pretty clearly symbolic. It's pretty clearly prophetic. It's just a different kind of prophecy. A historical prophecy is the prophet says this is what will happen. And these kind of prophecies show something happening. And then when the prophesized version happens, you have to say, wow, that's pretty obvious there. All right, so sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I go. I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering, placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, Father, yes, my son, Abraham replied, the fire and the wood are here, Isaac said, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And again, who's the father in this case? Okay, but symbolic. God. And who's the son?
Isaac.
Jesus. He gave his one and only son as a sacrifice. You could say, well, you know, it's just a coincidence there, okay? If that was all, I think coincidence would be a reasonable thing to argue for. But then it says, take him to Mount Moriah. He take him to the same mountain that Jesus was killed on. Because Mount Moriah is the mountain that Jerusalem was built on. And then it says, on the third day. And that ain't no accident. And whoever wrote down Genesis obviously had no idea. And again, it's like a play. Abraham is sort of acting out a play of which he has no idea. But it's no accident that it was on the third day. Because like it says in Hebrews 11, verse 19, figuratively, Abraham received his son back from the dead on the third day. And then there's 1 Corinthians 15:6, where Paul said, it was prophesied that the Messiah would die according to the scriptures. And it also says that the Messiah would be raised from the dead on the third day according to the scriptures. There's no historical prophecy of that. The prophecy of the resurrection on the third day is right here. And like it says in Hebrews 11, 19, figuratively, Abraham received his son back from the dead on the third day. And the symbolism is really pretty powerful. Abraham willingly offering up his only son. I don't think he wanted to do that. I don't think so.
Isaac didn't really die here. I mean,
but right, but in his mind, his son was as good as dead. His son was as good as dead, and he received his act.
Did you ever read the Passover plot? I did. Are you familiar?
I've heard about it. What's?
I'm just wondering if they use that for an argument that Isaac didn't really die. One of the main arguments is
whoever wrote the book, the Passover plot, is not sophisticated enough to read Genesis 22.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty
okay.
Sure. Yeah. If you know that one, it's a low quality grade B novel. Claiming that Jesus didn't really actually die and that kind of stuff. Yeah, I doubt very much that they would have been sophisticated enough to think about Genesis 22 as a foreshadow. Yes?
Anybody here that's a parent knows that if we were told by God to take our son and sacrifice him and kill him and bring the fire and bring the wood and our son, we know that there's nothing more intensely powerful than being asked
and taking the wood and making his son carry the wood up the mountain. The symbolism here is pretty powerful. Because Isaac carried the wood up the mountain that was going to be used for his own sacrifice, the same mountain, and Jesus carried up the wood to be used for his own sacrifice. All right? The symbolism, the connection, the prophecy is rather powerful, I would say. All right, so that's another example of how we can find Jesus in the Old Testament, but also evidence that Jesus is who he said he was. Because I'll guarantee you, when Jesus read Genesis 22, he knew exactly what it was about. And he went through with it. In fact, he continued to march to Jerusalem. So you preach that one, but this is a class. We're not supposed to be preaching.
Let's go, bro.
All right. Numbers 21, Genesis 22, 1 through 11. I just love the picture. And by the way, notice who carried the knife. The instrument of death was in God's hand here. All right? They're not going to blame the Jews for the death of Jesus. No way. That's totally unacceptable. All right, and now we can talk about the Passover. I'm skipping a bunch of stuff. And there's so many things related to the Passover that are amazing foreshadows and prefigures. But I thought I'd kind of zero in on this one, partly because I didn't do it when I was did the sermon a few weeks ago. All right, the Passover is a pretty cool a historical foreshadow or prefigure. Now, the story is in Exodus 3, 7 through 10. Let's turn there. We're not going to read the whole account about the Exodus. It's pretty long and involved. But, you know, again, you could argue that it just sort of happened this way. It's just an accident. And, you know, this is a pretty long series of singularly beneficial accidents, if that's in fact what it is. All right, Exodus 3, starting in verse 7. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of the slave drivers. I don't know why this passage is on that screen, because that's the wrong one for this thing that I'm talking about. It's going to be later on. I had the wrong one, but I apologize. Okay, so later on, I will have all these things. Exodus 12. Yes, Exodus 12. I mean, Exodus 3, 7 through 10 is about the Exodus and God saying he's going to let his people go. So that actually connects to the story. It's just not, it's that it's not directly about the Passover per se. And what is the Passover about, by the way? Just somebody tell me, what's the story about the Passover? Exodus 12. Right.
See,
God had said through Moses to Pharaoh, "Hey, you need to let my people go." And Pharaoh said, "No, I can do it." And the frogs were not enough. The hailstones were not enough. The blood was not enough. So it had to really hurt. So God said, "I'm going to take your firstborn son." He said that to Pharaoh. Not only your firstborn son, but when the people all lose their firstborn sons, they're going to look to you directly for not letting God's people go. And it worked. All right? It's kind of cool, actually. All right? Let me see. Verse Exodus 12. Let me see. Sorry about that. I'm not as... All right. We can read verse 14. So it says here, let's see. This is the day you're to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. For 7 days you're to eat bread made without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses. For whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day through the seventh must be cut off from Israel. On the first day, hold a sacred assembly. And another one on the seventh day, do no work at all on these days except to prepare food for everyone to eat. That is all you may do. So he's talking about the Passover and also the Feast of Unleavened Bread. I'm going to talk about the Feast of Unleavened Bread in my sermon tomorrow. Anyway, here's the deal. The final plague, there's a death sentence on all the firstborn children of the livestock and of the people. And really, all of us live under a death sentence. All of us who sin live under a death sentence. Similarly, all right, all of us were enslaved as the Jews were enslaved. So the event is a foreshadow of the death of Jesus on the cross. The blood of the Passover lamb saved the firstborn of Israel from physical death. Okay, so the idea was what they did was they killed a Passover lamb, a perfect Passover lamb, without breaking any of its bones, please. Then they took the blood from the Passover lamb and they put it on the wooden beam above their house. And when the destroying angel came, those who had the wooden beam over their house, their firstborn sons were not killed. And so what they were being asked to do is, for eternity, to remember that, that event of being saved from death and... because that very day they left Egypt. So being saved from death and for being saved from slavery, and spiritually, those are really the same thing, actually. So the blood of the Passover lamb saved the firstborn of Israel from physical death, and the blood of Jesus saves shed on the Passover. By the way, it ain't no accident that Jesus was killed not on the Passover, actually on the eve of the Passover. Because when did they kill lambs? They killed the lambs on the eve of the Passover, not on the Passover.
Wow.
And Jesus died on that same day. And his death saves us from spiritual death. The Passover freed Israel from physical bondage and physical slavery as the blood of the Passover lamb shed on a wooden beam, as happened with the Passover lamb, saves us from spiritual bondage, the spiritual sin. The Passover required an unblemished lamb, as Jesus is an unblemished lamb. John 1:29, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 5:7. All right, you're going to argue for coincidence on this, Mr. Skeptic? What they're going to do is just not even read it at all. They don't usually get this far. Verse 7. He's talking about sin, of course. It says, get rid of the old yeast, that you may be a new batch without yeast, as you really are. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the festival. What's he talking about? Passover, but the Christian Passover, right? Not with the old yeast, the yeast made of malice and wickedness, but with bread made without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth. And then my favorite is Revelation 13:8, which describes Jesus as a lamb slain from the creation of the world. Some people ask me, you know, how is it that the Jews could be saved if they're not... You're telling me you have to be baptized into Christ, so, you know, you have to be a Christian to be saved. What about these other people? Well, I don't know how it works. I have no idea. I mean, God's going to save. Who's going to save? He's going to take to heaven. He's going to take to heaven. I don't know. And I'm not going to stand there as judge about that. No way. But I do know this, that nobody's going to get into heaven without the blood of the Lamb. But the blood of the Lamb has been slain, in God's eyes, from the creation of the world. All right? So the blood was sprinkled on the crossbeam above the house. And similarly, Jesus' blood was also smeared on a crossbeam. And the result of the blood was to save from death and to free from slavery. The result of Jesus' blood is to save from death and free from slavery. Now, God said in Exodus 12, verse 46, he said, don't break any of the bones. Now, we wouldn't care about that, but the Jews would care about that. Why do they want to break the bones? Because it's the best part. It's like, oh, we can't break the bones. I was in Nigeria a couple years ago eating chicken, and, you know, we're just having a nice little meal of chicken, and I heard the crunch, crunch, crunch. I look over, and the whole piece was gone. They ate the whole thing, you know. They don't just eat the marrow, they actually eat the bones, the whole thing. It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's nice. But it's the best part because it tastes good. Tastes good. I tried it. I ate the whole leg. Yeah. Takes a little getting used to, but it's all right. It's good. It builds up the calcium levels. Okay? Yeah. Because of the symbolism. She asked, why was the stipulation not break the bones? Because when the Passover lamb was killed and his blood was put on the crossbeam to free us from slavery and to free us from death, they didn't break any of his bones. All right, that's a multiple prophecy. It's prophesied in Psalm 22. There's at least one other prophecy in Psalms that mentions not breaking any bones. But I don't have it here. There's at least one other. And so it's a prophecy. That the Passover lamb, the actual one, the real one, would not have any of his bones broken, which is a reference to what happened to the thieves on the site. All right, to me it's pretty clear what God was doing there. Yeah.
Why did they break the bones?
They broke the bones. Remember, it was the eve of the Passover. All this timing is so amazing. It's so spectacular.
Speed up.
Because they had to the crucifixion had to happen on the eve of the Passover. To fulfill, obviously, what's going on here. But if you crucify somebody on the eve of the Passover, crucifixions took between 12 and 36 hours, depending on the person. And so, for the Jews to have somebody on the cross on the actual Passover was a total, you know, this totally unacceptable. So they demanded them to end the crucifixion, and they did, except Jesus was already dead. The way you end a crucifixion is if you break the bones, they can no longer push up, in which case they suffocate within just a few minutes. They didn't have to do that with Jesus. Instead, they pierced him. All this stuff, it's like a symphony coming together. All this stuff, and a little thing from Exodus, a little thing from, you know, Psalms, a little thing from over here and from over there. And the idea that this just happened and it's that Jesus is not the Messiah, it's really, truly ridiculous, I would say. Truly ridiculous. So we got the idea of not breaking any of the bones, but that's not it. And by the way, not only is the Passover a symbol of Jesus' death, it's also a symbol of the Lord's Supper. And the entire Lord's Supper is kind of a pre-enactment. It's a pre-enactment of the death of Jesus. It's interesting. Part of what Jesus did at the Passover meal was stuff that wasn't even normally done at the Passover meal. It was done at the Passover, but anticipation of the fact that Jesus was going to be dead by then, he did kind of an amped-up Seder meal because of what was about to happen. So instead of calling it the Last Supper, we should probably call it the Last Seder, which is the pre-Passover meal. Jesus was celebrating the Passover meal with his people. And he said, it's kind of interesting, this is in Luke 22:16. Let's read that, Luke 22:16. Jesus was totally aware of all the symbolism, of all this, the prophecy fulfillment going on around him. His friends were, of course, as usual, completely clueless. All right, verse 14 and 15. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. Wow, that alone is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But for I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds its fulfillment in the kingdom of God. And what is the fulfillment of this supper? It is the Lord's Supper. Okay. Under a death sentence, pure and defiled Passover lamb. James reminded me to forward the thing there. Yes, thank you. But that's not all. The Passover meal was given as a remembrance of God's salvation. And what is the Lord's Supper anyway? It's a remembrance of God's salvation. That's Exodus 12:14. The Passover meal includes unleavened bread. Now, the reason, of course, is because they had to leave and they didn't have time to bake bread. All right, fine. That's why, that's the historical reason. But the reason for us is because what the yeast represents. When the Jews gave their bread the bread sacrifice, they were never allowed to include yeast. And yeast is symbolic of sin. So as we take the Lord's Supper, we too should remove that leaven. Not that we can actually become sinless. So that the Jews had to leave their life of slavery so hastily that they used unleavened bread. And how quickly should we leave our sin anyway?
Immediately.
Probably immediately. Amen. And not look back, Luke 9:62. Don't you think so?
Yep. Yes.
Because in 1 Corinthians 5:7-8 it says, a little leaven worked through the whole batch. Therefore, let us keep the festival. The Passover meal included a sacrificial lamb without defect, obviously, and also bitter herbs. God wanted them to remember how terrible it was in slavery. How could they forget that it was terrible in slavery? Well, how could you forget?
Right.
How could you forget how terrible it was being a Christian? How many of us have been tempted to go back? A lot of us. And then, you know, in the Last Supper, it mentions him. It got me confused because in one gospel account, he takes the cup first and then the bread. In another gospel account, he takes the bread and then the cup. Did you ever notice that?
Yeah.
And so obviously, we don't know which to do first, and somebody got it wrong. No, that's not what happened. Because in the Jewish Passover, they would take three cups. The first cup, and if you've ever been, you've been to more than one Seder, probably, right? Because his uncle does Seders fairly often. But anyway, it's the third cup. The third cup is the one after the supper. And the Jews call it the cup of redemption. So the one that Jesus took after the supper. By the way, you could do the bread or the wine in either order. It doesn't matter. But, you know, since they did both, it really doesn't matter. So there's some pretty cool prefiguring there in Passover, I would say. All right, and then there's the passing through the Red Sea that I'm going to skip. Let's talk about some prefigures of the Messiah. That's pretty cool. All right, now, the Jews had prophet, priest, and king, and in order to be a prefigure of the Messiah, you have to be a prophet, a priest, or a king. And I'm telling you, you can recount the entire biography of Jesus just from those who act as prefigures of the Messiah. And it's truly amazing. And if you don't believe that God intended this, then, if you know these events in these people's lives, and if you know the life of Jesus, and if you say this is an accident, then I say it's an accident that, throw a rock at somebody and hit them, it's an accident because you threw it at them or something. I don't know. I'm not coming up with a good illustration here. I'm sorry. So, what about Jonah? So I'm purposely going to choose a little mini itsy bitsy prefigure of the Messiah rather than a big one. Okay? There's a lot of parallel between Jonah and Jesus because, like Paul said, it was prophesied that the Messiah would be raised from the dead on the third day. And in Matthew 12, Jesus says, just like Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights, so I too will be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. All right, they said to Jesus, no prophet ever came from Galilee. Well, they're wrong, actually. One prophet came from Galilee. His name was Jonah. And why did they forget Jonah? Because they wanted to forget Jonah. Because the message of the book of Jonah is that salvation is for the Gentiles, too. And even Jonah didn't like that message. If you ask Jonah, is it okay to put Jonah in the Bible? He'd say, well, I like the name, but I don't like the book. Let's not put it in there at all. All right, because really, the story of Jonah is the prophecy that the Messiah's death will be not just for the Jews, but also for the Gentiles. And notice where Jonah comes from. He comes from Gath-Hepher, and look where Nazareth is. Nazareth and Gath-Hepher, they're like 3 miles apart. Right. From here to, just past San Diego State, basically. Yeah. That's how close they were. So, again, the prefigure of the Messiah, Jonah, comes from the same place where Jesus came from. All right? And he, like Jonah, was in the heart of the belly of something for 3 days and three nights. But that's not all. Because what we have here is a boat. And on a boat, that's what they say in Canada. A boat. A boat. They're on a boat, and all these guys are about to die. And this is a common situation in the Old Testament. You got a bunch of people who are about to die. It happened certainly in the case of the Passover. A bunch of people are about to die, so somebody has to die in their place. So what does Jonah do? He willingly offers himself. Jonah 1, verse 12, he says, here's the situation to your death penalty. Pick me up. Throw me into the sea. And he willingly offered his life to save the Gentiles. I'm sure later on he regretted having done that because, you know, he didn't like Gentiles. It was just one of those things. Why did I do that? But notice right before this happens, what are they doing?
Gambling.
They're gambling. Yeah. They're gambling. Just like with Jesus, they're gambling over his clothes. They're gambling over Jesus' clothes. They're gambling over Jonah's fate. I say that's not a coincidence. And then there's Melchizedek. The parallels between Melchizedek and Jesus are many. Melchizedek, like it says in Hebrews 7:2, is the king of righteousness, because that's what the name Melchizedek means. King of righteousness. Well, that's a pretty prideful name, I guess, king of righteousness. How'd you like, you know, hey, man, what are you called? I'm called King of Righteousness, right? He was King of Righteousness. Okay, actually, physically, though, he was the King of Salem. The city he was the king of was Salem. We normally use the word Shalom, all right? Shalom. He was the King of Peace. This prefigure of the Messiah was the King of Righteousness, and he literally was the King of Peace. There's some interesting stuff in Hebrews about him having no genealogy, no descendants. He's a priest forever. Psalms 110:4, it says, the Messiah will be a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So it says right there in Psalm 110 that the Messiah will be a priest, but a very strange priest, a priest like Melchizedek. And sure, that sure is true. Because Melchizedek was the king of Jerusalem. He was the king of physical Jerusalem, because Jesus is the king of spiritual Jerusalem. Jesus is the king of spiritual Zion. So, again, the Old Testament is physical, the New Testament is spiritual. Melchizedek is this king of spiritual Jerusalem, as Jesus is the king of spiritual Jerusalem, literally in every way. All right? A few other things. He's a priest, but not of the family of Levi, as Jesus is a priest, but not of the family of Levi. Melchizedek was a priest to the Jews and the Gentiles. How many priests did you have for Jews and Gentiles? And yet Jesus is a priest for Jews and Gentiles. And Abraham offered him a tithe. And the Hebrew writer sees that as symbolic of the fact that the Levitical priest is bowing down before the priesthood of Jesus. I wouldn't have gotten that, to be honest with you, but the Hebrew writer got it, so I'll go with that. All right. And notice, Abraham... Melchizedek gave Abraham bread and wine. I don't know. You can read about that in Genesis. Genesis 14. Melchizedek gave Abraham bread and wine. Body and blood. All right, so there's Melchizedek. There's some stuff about him that's kind of... You always ask those troubling questions. Of course he did.
Okay.
But what the Hebrew writer does, he uses the fact we don't know anything about his parents or his children. He uses that fact, interestingly, as a symbol. Again, I wouldn't have used it as a symbol that way, but the Hebrew writer does. He uses the fact that he has no known parents and no known descendants as somehow being symbolic of the fact that Jesus had no physical father and no descendants. And I wouldn't have done that, but the Hebrew writer did, so I figure he's cool. He can do that if he wants to. And then there's Joseph. The story of Joseph is the story of Jesus. Oh, my goodness gracious. Joseph was the right hand. He was the favorite son of his father. Genesis 37, verse 3. He was his favorite son. That worked out. Having favorite sons generally is not a good idea, unless you only have one son. Then you can have a favorite son. Like God. God could do that. He was his favorite son. But what happened to Joseph? He went from being at the right hand of his father to being a slave. Where? In Egypt, of course. And then what did God do? He raised him up to the right hand of the king. He went from the right hand of a king, if you will, to being a slave in Egypt, and back to the right hand of a king. Well, that right there is the biography of Jesus. Who was at the right hand of the Father, became a slave to live amongst a bunch of slaves, and God raised him back up to his right hand. But that's not all. He was a shepherd, and he had a dream in Genesis 37, 5 through 11. It's an awesome dream. And he dreamed that the 11 stars were going to bow down to him. And he dreamed that his sheath of wheat stood up above the others, and the other 11 sheaves all bowed down to him. He had a dream that he was going to be the king of the Jews. Luckily, his brothers said, awesome. No, instead they said, we're going to kill you. We're going to kill you. Is that a familiar story? Born at the right hand of the father, became a slave in Egypt, raised back up to the right hand, and his brothers decided to kill him. But God brought that plot to an end. Instead, they hatched another plot to betray him for 20 pieces of silver. Betray him into slavery. And it's been said, I don't know about this one, but it's been said, the approximate price of a slave at that time was 20 pieces of silver. And at the time of the first century of the Roman Empire, the approximate price of a slave was 30 pieces of silver. I don't know. I wouldn't want to go too far on that one. But remember, you can't be a prefigure of the Messiah unless you're either a priest, prophet, priest, or king, or prince, if you will. He certainly has qualified that. But you also have to save Israel. So does he meet the grade of saving Israel?
Totally.
Yeah, I would say so. Seemed to pull it off pretty well. And then there's Moses, who, like Jesus, was born. There's a king. There was a very, very powerful king who had this crazy irrational idea that a baby born to enslave Jews was going to replace him as king. So he decided to kill him, but he didn't know who to kill, so he decided to kill all the male children. That's Pharaoh. That's Moses. But you have to understand, Moses is Jesus. Moses is Jesus. Jesus is Moses. And so the parallel story, of course, is Herod. And Herod, crazy idea, he believed that a Jewish child would take over his role. A peasant Jewish child. He doesn't know who to kill, so he kills all the male babies. And God saves Jesus, and where does he send him down?
To Egypt.
Yeah. Why? Because out of Egypt I called my son, and because the Messiah has to go down to Egypt. The Messiah has to go to Egypt, symbolically. Which is what Joseph did, which is what Moses did, which is what Jesus did. That's just the way it is. And then the other parallels are pretty spectacular. God said to Moses, I'm going to send a prophet like you to save the people. Boy, did God fulfill that promise. Under death sentence as a baby, raised from poverty to be the prince in a king's house. All right. Called out of Egypt. Given the right-hand position of Pharaoh to be over God's people, willingly gave up that position. Moses was in the palace with the king, and yet he willingly became a slave to save God's people. Moses saved physical Israel from physical slavery in physical Egypt. Jesus saved spiritual Israel from spiritual bondage in spiritual Egypt. They were baptized into Moses. We're baptized into Christ. Read about that in 1 Corinthians 10, 1 through 4. Moses went out into the wilderness to prepare for his ministry for 40 years. Jesus went out to prepare for his ministry for 40 days. Moses gave them bread. Jesus is the bread of life. Moses gave them water from a rock. Jesus gives us the water that springs up for eternal life. John chapter 4, John chapter 6. Moses had Aaron. Jesus had John the Baptist. Moses went up Mount Sinai. Jesus went up on the Mount of Transfiguration and met up with Moses. All right. Coincidence? Accident? Or Jesus is the Messiah? I think Jesus is the Messiah. I don't know if I missed some stuff on that list. There's more. Then there's David. David is the ultimate prefigure of the Messiah, even more than Moses, at least from the Jewish perspective, because the Messiah has to be from Bethlehem. The Messiah has to be the branch of Jesse. Jesse was David's father. All right? And David, he was a shepherd. He was a pretty good shepherd. In fact, you know what? He was a very good shepherd. I mean, this crazy dude, he's a shepherd, he's got no weapons, the lion goes after the sheep, and David goes after the lion. He willingly gave his life to save stupid, smelly sheep. Save us. To tell us about Jesus. Born in Bethlehem, anointed as a king. And the anointment scene of David, same thing. The anointment scene of David in 1 Samuel 16 is a pre-enactment of the baptism of Jesus. He saved Israel about 1,000 times. The last time he saved Israel was right on Mount Moriah, when he said, the threshold of Aaron's house, which is where they built the temple, the same mountain. And he said, I refuse to offer a sacrifice that cost me nothing. And then there's just the whole story of David anyway. When you're reading the Psalms, are you reading about David or are you reading about the Messiah? The answer is yes. And then David also pre-enacted Palm Sunday, when Jesus marched into Jerusalem and the people are saying, Hosanna, the coming of the king to Israel. And they're laying a palm branch. That was pre-enacted when David brought the ark. He literally brought God into Jerusalem. And, Every major event in Jesus' life is represented, is told through those who are prophecies of the Messiah. All right? David, my servant, born in Bethlehem, a good shepherd, anointed as king. Again, like Melchizedek, the king of Jerusalem, because spiritually Jesus is the king of Zion, of Jerusalem, of the city on the hill. All right, and then there's the burnt offering. I think I might have mentioned that, and I'm running out of time, so I'll skip that. I might have mentioned that a couple weeks ago. The red heifer, that'll be the last one. I think that's the last one in our outline anyway. Red heifer? Uh-oh. Uh-oh, it's not going forward anymore. Oh, yeah, yeah, yes. I do not want to add some dumb program. You know. They're taking over my computer. There you go. Oh, the festivals. Come to the lesson tomorrow. Talk about the festival. Let's do the red heifer sacrifice, though. Numbers 19. Did you know that one of the sacrifices in the Old Testament was both for Jew and Gentile? Did you know that? The red heifer sacrifice was a purification for even for Gentiles. You can read about it in Numbers 19, 1 through 22. It is not an accident that the only sacrifice, the only ceremony that took care of the sins, in quotes, the purification problems of Gentiles, is an awesome prefigure of the Messiah. So we're going to end with that one right there. All right, the red heifer was a very rare red heifer. All right, and Jesus is a very rare and unique son. There, in the whole history of Judaism, there were only three red heifers, because the rule had to be every hair on this cow had to be red. And if you know the Jews, you know they're going over it literally with a fine-tooth comb, right? A few years ago, I think it was around 20, 25 years ago, they actually had a red heifer in Israel. And it was made the news, blah, 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 blah. But when it grew up, it had a few red hairs that weren't red and they couldn't use them. All right, so this red heifer is a prefigure of the Messiah in that way. Sacrificed outside the camp, as Jesus was sacrificed outside the camp, to purify both Jew and Gentile, as Jesus purifies both Jew and Gentile. A sacrifice without blemish, as Jesus is without blemish. Never been yoked. Says you, if you ever yoke this a bull, you cannot use it for the sacrifice. What's that about? Jesus voluntarily offering his sacrifice. If you ask the bull, would you sacrifice yourself voluntarily?
No.
You ask the sheep, no. Jesus voluntarily sacrificed. They combine scarlet wool and wood with the sacrifice, which is about the blood and the wood, which was prefigured in the situation with the Passover as well. They put in hyssop with the sacrifice, and hyssop is a symbolism of purification from sin. And they combine the ashes of the sacrifice with water for purification, as the blood of Jesus combines with the baptism of purification, Romans chapter 6, verse 4. All right, great. So we'll do the miracles 2 weeks from this morning. Thank you for coming.